Star Wars! Nothing but Star Wars!
TheForce.net and RebelScum.com present The Weekly ForceCast. And now your hosts, Jason and Pete.
We would be honored if you would join us.
And welcome to the ForceCast, the official podcast for TheForce.net and RebelScum.com. This is the September 1st, 2006 edition. I'm Jason.
And I'm Pete.
And this week's show is brought to you by Official Picks, officially licensed Star Wars photos and autographs. When buying from Official Picks, you no longer need to worry if your Star Wars autograph is genuine. Get your autographs from the only official source. That's officialpicks.com, picks with an X.com. Coming up on this week's show:
original trilogy DVD news, the future of the Star Wars brand, R2 and 3PO in the Smithsonian, Queen Amidala's AT-AT, and more, all feature in this week's headlines from the Force.net news desk.
We'll be in the cantina with composer Steve Parsons, and Steve will fill us in on how Star Wars composer John Williams has influenced Steve's work as a composer for stage, screen, and video games.
We'll be bounty hunting the latest offerings from Hasbro, Sideshow Toys, Lego, and more in our collecting segment.
And in gaming, Pete will be previewing Star Wars LEGO 2, the original trilogy, and some of the industry hype surrounding that game's release.
We'll delve into the expanded universe with the continuing Legacy of the Force storyline and the releases of Del Rey's Bloodlines and A Practical Man novels.
That's a lot to cover, so let's punch it!
I have good news for you, my lord.
That's good news.
Come closer, I have good news.
As this is our first show, it's only fitting that we make ourselves the top story. So we'd like to welcome everybody to the latest incarnation of the Force.net podcast, The ForceCast. Now, some of you may have been listeners to Eric's show.
Well, you know, sometimes life can get in the way of the hobbies that we all love and enjoy. And unfortunately, Eric isn't able to serve as host any longer. But we wish him all the best, and we're happy to be here.
So stick with us. We've got a lot of cool things in store for everybody in the Star Wars fan community. And we want to hear from you. So drop us an email at podcast@theforce.net and let us know what you think. But in the meantime, kick back, relax, and enjoy the rest of the show. The anticipated release of the original unaltered versions of Star Wars, The Empire Strikes Back, and Return of the Jedi on DVD is less than 2 weeks away, and the Lucasfilm promotion machine is in full gear. The Star Wars road trip featuring Darth Vader, Chewbacca, and Wicket is now making its rounds in the U.S. Miami, Florida, Louisville, Kentucky, and Columbus, Ohio have all had their encounters with the traveling trio, and if they happen to be coming to your city, be sure to be on the lookout and have your camera ready, because if you send in the winning photo op with these three, you could win a trip to Celebration 4 in Los Angeles in May of 2007. For full details of the picture contest and the remainder of the tour schedule, head over to StarWars.com. In addition, the Force.net news desk is being told that limited edition t-shirts are being randomly handed out at all the stops along the way. Pictures of the shirts can be found at TheForce.net. To celebrate the September 12 release date, StarWars.com has been updated with a special feature showcasing all of the visual improvements that have been made to A New Hope over the years. Since we'll be getting both versions, they've created a comparison photo gallery with 122 notable changes of the film. The gallery can be seen at StarWars.com. Also new to StarWars.com is a look back at the years in which the original trilogy films were initially released. See what songs were popular and many other interesting highlights that took place in 1977, 1980, and 1983 at StarWars.com. StarWars.com has also posted images of the upcoming DVD menus for A New Hope and The Empire Strikes Back. Designed by New Wave Entertainment, the animated menus are based on retro poster artwork for the three films. Elements of many of the original posters have been combined to create a nostalgic tip of the hat to the films that started it all. Menu photos of Return of the Jedi DVD should be posted at the homepage sometime next week. New Wave Entertainment, who designed the menus, have teamed up with Lucasfilm before on the Clone Wars Volume 2 and Revenge of the Sith bonus DVDs. And finally, retailers Walmart and Target have already announced their plans for incentive items to be given out free with the purchase of the DVDs on September 12th. Walmart's offerings include reprints of the original Marvel comic adaptations in a graphic novel format, and Target will include concept art renderings.
How much fun is this? You know, that's what I love about these releases is that there's so much going on that you can jump into, characters going around from place to place, and all these retailers trying to outdo each other on the bonuses to get you to come buy the DVDs.
The crime of it is, you know, it's been hard for me to justify buying multiple copies just to get the bonus incentives, but I guess if you have somebody, you know, on a Christmas list or something, or birthdays or anniversaries coming up, you can always find an excuse to buy extra ones, I suppose.
Yeah, that's always a great idea. Here's your gift. Can I keep these little posters?
It's been opened, but they haven't been played or anything. But have you seen the shirts that they're giving out on the tour?
Yeah, the shirts are really cool. They're simple, but they just scream Star Wars.
Yeah, I like them a lot. You know, I'm a big fan of the gray, you know, kind of washed out looking T-shirt, and these menus look awesome.
Yeah, the menus are really cool. They have a lot of animatics that filter, like especially the Empire one. We were talking about that earlier. It's got the animatic playing right into the poster and
yeah,
the menu. It, when it all comes together, I can see it in my mind. It's really going to look cool.
Exactly. And it seems like they've combined the posters kind of into, you know, one or two different concepts. So, I mean, you've got, for the Empire one, you've got I love the teaser poster, which is just Vader's head. You know, the saga continues. So that's really cool. And I kind of been enjoying that wave back machine thing they got going, where you look back and see what was going on in 77 and 80. Now, the 83 page isn't up yet as of time we're recording this, but the 77 one is particularly interesting to me because that was the year I was born.
Yeah, well, I was one, so it was kind of an in-between year for me, so I'm not as excited about it.
We want to know, with all the changes that have happened to A New Hope in the last 30 years, we want to know what you're most looking forward to in finally getting a copy of the unaltered version. So, you know, is it obviously Han shooting first is a big thing, but that's kind of the fanboy favorite.
I don't even know what you're talking about. Is there something to do with Han shooting first in any of the films?
Actually, you know what I'm looking forward to? The old-fashioned blaster marks that are left on the Rebel scum on the Tantive IV. That's what I'm looking for.
Between that and the original Ewok song, those are the things that I'm really on top of.
Yub nub.
Stephanie Kang of the Wall Street Journal took a look at the current success of the Star Wars franchise and what's on tap for the 30th anniversary. Star Wars consistently enjoys tremendous popularity, regardless of the fact that there won't be any more movies for fans to flock to, and Lucasfilm plans to continue that trend with a multimedia release for 2007. Lucasfilm will be exploring untouched areas of the Star Wars timeline in a next-generation game that will be accompanied by action figures, vehicles, and a media campaign to precede the launch. This is a strategy that Lucasfilm hopes will keep the movie's merchandising empire rolling, which is dependent on generating new stories and fresh approaches to the iconic characters and their world. Many studios desire to match Star Wars' success, but few are even able to match its initial success. Experts say Star Wars goods have shown surprising strength this year, despite the absence of a new movie, even beating out merchandise from summer flicks such as Cars, Superman Returns, and Pirates of the Caribbean: Dead Man's Chest. Star Wars is the top seller so far this year of action figures and the biggest merchandiser for boys' toys, with it selling more than double its nearest movie merchandising competitor this summer, Cars. The Force.net's own Philip Wise chimes in that high-end merchandise continues to help drive the fan interest. With all that in the works, Star Wars fans should be able to enjoy their favorite characters for years to come.
Well, you know, in 95, you know, between 95 and 99, there were no new movies. I mean, they did do the special editions, but so they had four really good, strong years with a lot of merchandise, including the Shadows of the Empire multimedia campaign, which, gosh, going back to, like, you know, 97, 98, the technology wasn't nearly where it is now to really pull this off.
Right, and you know, that's something that Star Wars fans already know, is that Star Wars is a franchise that we all are fully into. However, sometimes it's always good to have an article like this come out and show the rest of the world and the business world and everybody else who may look down their nose at us that, yeah, we're the big dog on the block, and we're going to keep it going even though there's no other films that are coming out.
I really don't think the fact that there are no new movies coming out is all that big of a deal. I mean, we know that we've got a cartoon coming up. We know that we've got an hour-long weekly series, live-action series coming on.
Well, you know, it's always funny because there are so many people that came up to me after episode 3 came out and said to me, "I'm so sorry, what are you going to do now?" Like, they're offering their condolences like I, you know, was just going to have to crawl into a cave and die. And I was like, no, there's tons of stuff going on. Really? Oh, yeah. Here, check out this article. I can send that to them now. So,
and I have to laugh whenever I hear about other properties not doing as well. And I think this goes back to Kenner's vision. I really do. I think so much of the merchandising empire that was built has to do with Kenner's vision of having such an expansive line of figures, which, I mean, it showed other manufacturers and producers of merchandise that kids just don't want, you know, incarnations of the five main characters. Pirates of the Caribbean, Harry Potter, I can think of, you know, a lot of the Disney and the Pixar films, they don't get it. You get a toy line with maybe five or six characters, and that's it. And they wonder why they don't go off the shelves.
Right. You know, the 18 different Supermans that you could buy weren't enough.
What can you say? They get it. A recent segment on Comedy Central's The Colbert Report featured host Stephen Colbert swinging a lightsaber against a green screen with the joke that George Lucas would add effects to it later. Leave it to Star Wars fans to do it themselves. After an unofficial contest sprung up on the net, The Colbert Report officially put out a call for fans to modify the footage. Later, on the Thursday, August 24th episode, TFN's own filmmaker, Jacob Kafka, also known as Weird Hat, was the latest entry to be shown on the program, to the obvious approval of both Colbert and the audience. You can view his entry online at weirdhat.com. Kafka's TheForce.net animated film, Beagle, can be seen at TheForce.net/fanfilms. Now, I didn't see the raw footage.
Neither did I.
But I can imagine how ridiculous it must have been. But I gotta say, he looks pretty skilled. It just goes to show that what a difference the effects can make. Because, I mean, obviously, he probably looked like a total ass, you know, just going around without any of the effects. But Kafka went and put a Rancor monster in it. They put him on some ship, obviously animated the lightsaber, and he kind of made him look like he knew what he was doing. That was really the amazing thing for me.
Yeah, so here's Stephen Colbert in suit, looking like Jedi Master, and shows everybody again another tip of the cap to Star Wars fan community that there's a lot of creativity out there, and these are people who just do this as a hobby just because they love it.
Yeah, I can't even imagine just knowing how to do that. I think that was Battlefront footage that he threw in there.
I'm not sure where it came from. It all looked familiar.
You know, if only Kafka could have gotten a hold of his hands on the Star Wars kid footage.
Yeah, we saw what they did with that anyway, so.
Well, yeah, but I mean, you know, maybe instead of a Rancor, it could have been the local school bully he could have taken out.
Close Off Our Backs Foundation is holding an auction of special items autographed by Star Wars diva Natalie Portman to benefit the Milo Gladstein Foundation for Bloom Syndrome. Featured items from the Star Wars universe are an Episode 1 Hasbro Queen Amidala costume box, a Hasbro Phantom Menace electronic Naboo Royal Starship, and a very rare musical snow globe of a AT-AT that was only given to cast members. Outside of the Star Wars items, there's also a Natalie Portman dress and a couple signed V for Vendetta posters. The auction lasts through September 15th, and if you want to get in on the action, make sure you bring your checkbook because they already have some very sizable bids. If you'd like to check out the auction, you can visit closeoffourbacks.org and click on the Natalie Portman special auction.
So is this a live auction, or is this you're actually doing this online?
This is an online auction, much like eBay. You're just bidding on the item. You know, like I said, they've got some pretty large size bids already, but that shouldn't keep you from trying to get in on the action.
I kind of like that snow globe.
Well, I know you weren't a big fan of it at first. You kind of blew it off a little bit. Yeah,
I poo-pooed, and then I realized that it was given out only to cast members, and I thought, wow, that's really special all of a sudden.
Yeah, although at this point of our recording, the bid up to $1,551, so a little bit out of my price range.
I'm sitting here kind of weighing AT-AT Snow Globe or my wife.
The Walt Disney Company held open auditions for Jedi characters to star in a live stage production at their California Disneyland park. The production, titled Jedi Training Academy, will allow young audience members to be trained by a Jedi in preparation to fight a real live Star Wars villain. The show is set to begin sometime later in the fall. All right, I've got a real beef with this.
Uh-oh.
Okay.
As a former theater major, I'm sensing something coming through here.
Well, yes, costume Disney characters, that is where all theater majors go to die, all out-of-work theater majors. But here's my problem with this. Here are the requirements. You tell me if there's something wrong. At least 18. Okay, I can understand that.
Sure.
All ethnicities welcome. It is inclusive.
Aliens,
can't argue
whatever.
With that. That's right. Male.
Yeah, yeah, we're treading on some thin ice there.
Yeah, we might have some female fans out there that might be upset. 18 to 45. I'm down with it.
Okay, fine. Okay.
Athletic build. I'm still in. I'm still in the
okay,
running here.
Okay, we're okay. Still there.
Moves well. Possibly. Sword work, a plus. Whenever they say a plus, it means it's not necessary, but it's a plus.
Strong actor with comedic timing. All right, I'm still in, I think.
Yeah, you're still there.
Improvisational skills. Okay.
Yeah, we're working.
Able to interact with young guests. Okay.
Ooh, that could be a speed bump for some people.
Yeah. But I think I could do it. Here's the clincher. Must be 5'8".
Ooh, that eliminates a lot of Star Wars nerds.
Missed me by 4 inches. Have they never seen a Star Wars movie? Judge me by my size, do you? Have they ever heard of Yoda, the most powerful Jedi in the galaxy? That's right, friends. I said it. He is the most powerful Jedi in the galaxy. I don't care what anyone else says. But isn't this ridiculous? 5'8"?
Well, you know, I mean, that's typical casting, though. I would have to say that at some point they just say, well, 5'8" sounds good.
Yeah, that's why I'm a theater major that works in insurance.
The Smithsonian's National Museum of American History announced yesterday that it has winnowed its vast collection of objects down to 150 greatest hits for display at the nearby Air and Space Museum, while the History Museum shuts down until 2008 for an extensive renovation. Included in that 150 are two familiar Star Wars faces, R2-D2 and C-3PO.
Have you ever been there?
I have.
You know, you got Archie Bunker's chair, you got the Fonz's jacket, you got Mr. Rogers' sweater. So it's very cool. They're winnowing this down to 150 items, and Star Wars made the list.
It just shows where Star Wars ranks in the annals of pop culture in America.
And you can read up on all the stories we talked about at theforce.net.
Where are you going, Master?
For a drink.
Sorry about the mess.
You will never find the more wretched hive of scum and villainy. We must be cautious.
We're joined in the cantina by Steve Parsons, composer, musician, arranger, and Star Wars fan, first and foremost, and a huge fan of John Williams. Steve, tell us a little bit about yourself and some of the things you've done in your professional career as a musician and composer.
Well, probably the most well-known thing that most people would probably at least immediately think of is The Tick, the animated series.
Right.
I actually played as part of the Tickestra for a number of episodes of that show.
Yeah.
So I'm kind of looking forward to the DVD.
Oh, very cool.
To be able to hear what I did. It'll mean so much. And I've also done music for the Acclaim video game College Slam, which some people may remember from the, however many years ago that
takes
was.
Me back to high school, I think. Yeah, so like, somewhere around the mid-90s.
Mid-90s. I don't even remember what platform it was for.
Atari 64.
No. I did music for that video game. And then I also, if everyone remembers the movie Footloose, I did the new arrangements for the stage production of Footloose for the Oscar-winning author.
Awesome. Very cool. Well, the reason we invited you here is you're a friend, but you're also a big Star Wars fan and a huge John Williams fan. And you actually got to meet him at one point, didn't you?
Yes. I went to 2 concerts up at Blossom Music Center in Cleveland area. The first time he was there was with the Boston Pops. It was when he was still the conductor. And I ended up just hanging out at the green room afterwards, and he came out and was talking to people and actually exchanged a couple of words with him.
Very cool. Do you remember what you said?
He asked me how the balance of the orchestra was out in the house, and I said, it was pretty good. You know, the drums were a little boomy, but it's outside. So.
So he asked you, and you gave him a real honest answer then.
I did. I was just like, it was great.
Well, you wanted him to know that you were a pro.
Right.
And you could tell the difference.
I'm sure he could tell.
So you saw him twice? Did you only meet him the one time then?
Yes. The second time was obviously post-Boston Pops, and he was in town conducting a whole concert of his work with the Cleveland Orchestra, which was a great concert. It was actually better than the other concert, but didn't get to meet him that time.
What was the first Star Wars movie you saw?
Dad took us to see it in its first original run. So
is that right? In 77, then?
Yeah. Part of the original nerds.
Do you remember where it was?
The very first one we saw on vacation in Virginia Beach.
Very cool. How old were you then, you remember?
5.
5 years old. It had an impression on you then?
Yeah, because actually I had some of the books and other things they'd already gotten me, because you know, Dad was a big kind of sci-fi geek, and so he kind of passed that along to the rest of us.
That's a great thing to hand down to your kid.
Oh, yeah.
Instead of athletic prowess or anything like that. So you saw the movie, and by the time you were 5, were you musical then? I mean, did you realize that you had some gifts, some strengths there?
Yeah, actually, I had started to kind of pick stuff out on the piano, and we sang a lot. What other people like Mom and others have told me, it was a definite early aptitude.
I just want to kind of go back again, because we're talking about Star Wars here, since we're in the cantina and the band is playing. Seeing the movie at that age and having those musical sensibilities, did the music speak to you? I mean, was the music something that you really took notice of even at that age?
Yeah, I would say that was probably one of the things that made the most impression, because, you know, Star Wars was obviously this huge phenomenon from out of nowhere, and people were really excited about it because you had the special effects and everything. But I remember as a kid, the biggest thing that stood out to me was just that opening of just, you know, wham. It's like everyone knew, okay, we're gonna have a good time because this is, you know, this cool phenomena. But it's just like, no, the music like tells you, no, you're really gonna have a good time with this,
right? Absolutely. And at the time it was relatively different, and I know Lucas got into some trouble because he didn't want any credits at the beginning of the film.
Right,
he wanted to put you right into it from the beginning.
Yeah, no starring,
right?
Music by,
right, plus, you know, most everybody, if they would have rolled the credits at the beginning, they would have been like, who?
Exactly.
Who? Oh, Alec Guinness. Oh, yeah. I think I remember him. Bridge on the River Kwai or whatever. Do you have a favorite? Is there one particular score you like, you know, one more than the other? Or?
I have to admit, probably my favorite is still the absolute original, because, you know, that's the one where all the themes and everything else was established. It was new then, so it was kind of like, this is Star Wars. There was no, you know, Star Wars : The Empire Strikes Back. Or, there was
right,
no,
right.
I mean, the original trilogy works musically as well as it does dramatically, so I mean, all three of them are kind of like really dear, but yeah, the first one is probably still my favorite, because it just has those big sweeping moments, and the London Symphony, how can you beat that? I have a lot of different influences, but he was one of the primary influences in getting me interested in music and composing music and realizing how music works dramatically.
What do you think the secret is to his success? I mean, he's garnered more Academy Award nominations, I think, than any living composer. I think he's actually won more Academy Awards than any living composer.
And as he puts it, he's actually lost more than any living composer.
Well, that's pretty typical. I mean, in all the interviews that I've read and heard of him, he's very, very humble, and he doesn't take it too seriously. When you hear a John Williams score, you recognize it. Why is that?
Even though, obviously, his scores have a great deal of complexity to them, he understands the nature of finding a hook to it, you know, which we, you know, in pop music they call the hook. But, you know, melodically, you repeat phrases enough that you can really have that stick in your brain without becoming, you know, boring and repetitious.
Can you give me some examples in the Star Wars score that come to mind?
I mean, the absolute best example is, you know, the original theme. You've got da-da-da-da,
right,
all those little triplet
right.
figures. If you think about it, they're all over the place.
Right,
so
yeah.
You hear it so much that your brain kind of goes, oh, okay, I recognize that.
Sure.
So he understands the value in a simple but not simplistic theme that can then be used, you know, throughout the entire movie. So you're hearing it so much that you can't help but think, oh, that's Luke's theme.
Right. And that's for me, that's probably it, is his ability to create themes that I will remember after only seeing the movie maybe one time. I remember after seeing the first Jurassic Park, I was leaving the theater and I was kept humming that same little part over and over and over again. And he uses it in various ways throughout the movie. He can use it when it's a nice kind of serene, peaceful moment. And he can also use it when there's, you know, a T-Rex chasing you.
Right. Because he's using it dramatically, where you relate it to characters and situation, he's able to repeat it enough that your brain just latches right onto it. Most of John Williams' projects are obviously almost larger than life. You know, you're talking Star Wars, Superman, E.T., all these huge...
Harry Potter.
Yeah, I mean, those are very larger than life projects. So he has the advantage of being able to go a little bit beyond just, okay, I'm the accompaniment, or I'm the score.
You right.
know, the music is a lot more present. There are a couple of film score, like old school guys, Bruce Broft and a couple of other people that complained a lot about the fact that they took a lot of risks back in the day because they were sitting in a piano with like a videotape or, you know, some, you know, depending on what era
right,
you're talking
right.
and a pencil and paper and wrote the score, you know, and used a stopwatch and did timings.
Wow.
Whereas now everything's temp tracked, you know, you do
sure.
synth demos, you know, you lay it over the film and so the director can sit with it and go back and forth and be like, it wasn't quite, or a lot of times they'll be like, okay, this is the temp track. It's one of your own pieces.
Right.
Write something kind of like, exactly like that, but new.
When Spielberg actually introduced John Williams to Lucas, when Spielberg heard what type of project Lucas was looking to do, and I know that Lucas said that he wanted not an old-fashioned composer, but a composer that understood the importance of the music in a film. And in fact, you know, Steven, I think, had said to George Lucas that the music in Jaws is the shark.
Absolutely, yeah.
It's playing the role.
It's not the puppet or the little mechanical.
That was Jaws 4. Well, with the puppet.
No, absolutely. You have to have somebody, because writing music is, and this is one of the reasons that I'm so interested in theater as well, writing music goes hand in hand with dramatic writing, mm-hmm. at least in its romantic, you know, kind of romantic form.
Right.
Because you're dealing with character, or at least ideas and development and, you know, conflict and resolution and all the same elements you're dealing with in drama. So you need to have somebody who's classically schooled enough that they understand how to apply, you know, the dramatic situation to the music, or in vice versa. That's exactly why Williams was able to capture that, so because he treated it seriously. I mean, that's probably Williams' like biggest strength as a composer. He doesn't write down to his subjects. He's like, oh, I'm writing a sci-fi movie, so I can write, you know, TikTok music, or you know, boops and beeps, or, you know, whatever else. You know,
right?
He thinks, okay, this is a serious dramatic story, and how do I best serve the story? Which is, I think, why Star Wars, the score, is just... It took off.
It's not a sci-fi score.
No.
Really. I mean, you could pull that score out and probably, as an experiment, throw the music into a film like Lawrence of Arabia.
Yeah.
Or something epic in scale like that.
Yeah, it's very romantic, very sweeping, and it has a lot of very militaristic elements, obviously. You know, in fact, the opening is so, you know, drum-heavy because
right.
Lucas originally wanted the war drums or something, whatever.
Right.
Yeah, I mean, you could definitely see that in another setting, that, you know, with equal drama and still work. I mean, so yeah, he doesn't. Superman, you know, especially Star Wars, you could kind of see, okay, somebody came up with something creative because what's Star Wars? You know,
right,
when it first came out, what's this crazy Lucas doing with this, you know, this, you know, this funny space film?
Right.
So that obviously, you can at least see somebody thinking outside of the box for that. But like Superman, you know, you have another case where, okay, it's Superman. Everybody knows Superman. So John Williams was able to draw on his own, you know, kind of ideas of what Superman was, but he still didn't write down to it. You know, he didn't think, oh, it's super, you know, Superman, so I can just write a stupid march and everyone will be happy.
Looking at the six films and the six scores, 16 years in between, what is some of the biggest differences in Williams as a composer listening to his last score in Jedi and then going into Phantom Menace?
One nice thing is that it holds up remarkably well, and that it does feel like it's part of the whole picture. You know, it didn't feel like he completely forgot what he was doing back then.
Right.
But I think the big differences are instrumentation.
Okay.
You know, he used some different, more ethnic stuff than he used in the originals, I think. Not that he didn't use a lot, but there's more... We've incorporated more Celtic and Indian and other instruments into film scoring in the meantime, you know, on a more regular basis. So I think there was just, like, the availability of all these other instruments to draw from.
Where do you think the choir came from? All of a sudden, there's choral music. We had heard that with the Emperor's theme in Jedi. There was kind of a low, bassy, you know. But that was really the only vocals that you heard, other than Sice Noodles.
Right. I think, if I remember correctly, and I could be completely misrepresenting this, so...
we'll fact check you, of course.
Yes. In reading what he said, if I remember correctly, because he used it in the Emperor's theme and in those sequences, he kind of thought of it as, okay, I'm going now back in time to these older this older period, so it makes more sense. These are very epic, you know, things that we're dealing with, you know, the whole fate of the galaxy resting on, you know, the Chosen One and all that. So
right.
I think he kind of thought, well, that's perfect, kind of almost religious undertones, so why not throw in the choir and kind of hint that, okay, you heard this before, here's where it came from. And in fact, a lot of times when he uses the choir, and especially the Phantom Menace, they're doing something either very similar or something that was based off of the Emperor's theme.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Okay. I'll have to go back and listen to that a little bit.
In fact, if you notice, the very last cue of Episode 1 is actually a major, like kind of a major key happy version of part of the Emperor's music from Return of the Jedi.
I never noticed that.
Yeah, it's just, it's really kind of cool.
Wow. See, again, the sensitive ears of the composer. But, you know, thinking about this little boy and this little, and this very wispy theme that he has to incorporate the recognizable Imperial March.
Well, if you notice, and there's the anytime the Sith spacecraft are shown, there's this little like dun 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 dun.
Right, right.
So it's like he's kind of combining the Sith with Anakin's theme, and then it becomes Darth Vader's theme. It's like we call it deconstructing. He like wrote an original theme, and then you find out, okay, what do I have here to work with thematically, and then you kind of just deconstruct elements of that theme.
Very cool. Very cool. I can't wait to now, after talking to you, to go back and listen to the scores again so I can pick out some of these things. They're like little Easter eggs you can give us. You'll have to give us a list at some point. We can post it on our show notes of things to listen for.
Absolutely.
Because the thing that I love about my fellow Star Wars fans is they're not just casual watchers of film. In fact, I think in a lot of ways they're much more critical on the work than the non-fans in a lot of ways.
Oh, yeah. Who am I to argue with passion?
I don't know who it was that said this. It might have been George Lucas. I know I remember hearing it somewhere where they said that if you took out all of the dialogue and just had the music and played the movies, you could tell exactly what's going on.
Oh, absolutely. Because Williams treated it like almost like an opera. In fact, I think he used the Wagner reference, you know, how he treated it like The Ring and basically just told the story through the music. And I completely agree. It tells you what's going on. You know what character's either being thought of or is doing
right.
The thinking.
And then the Episode 3 soundtrack that included the DVD.
Yes.
I love that. I will put that in. I put it in a lot, actually, and just have it on as background. Because, you know, you got the music right there. And if you turn and watch, it tells the story of the characters so beautifully. I mean, the way they cut the scenes together and with the music. So that really cemented in my mind just how instrumental the music was in telling the story.
Yeah, it was one of the smartest decisions that Lucas made in going with that type of a score and in making sure Williams scored every single one of them.
What do you think of some of the fan films that make their way around the internet? Have you caught any of them? Some of the things that you see on YouTube?
Yeah, I've seen a number of those. A lot of them are very effective. They're almost more effective in terms of dialogue. But, I mean, they're very effective in giving you little glimpses of what could have been happening, like on the other side of the camera, if you're assuming that, you know, if you pretend that Star Wars is like a documentary, it's
turn
away from the camera for a minute, and over there, you know, this is going on, or this little subplot's going on, or, you know, some other planet that you never even saw in the movies.
Actually, that's my favorite part of, you know, EU, of the Expanded Universe, is when they take a plot and put it right in the middle of something that's very familiar, that you know, that in the movies, and then it, like, just like what you said, like, they're just turning the camera the other way, and, well, what was Tarkin doing here, or what was Dash Rendar doing before Shadows of the Empire, and how Shadows fit so well between Empire and Jedi. Obviously, it was designed to do that, but it's not always easy.
Again, you're fitting into an existing framework, and you obviously don't want to tamper with the continuity of what's already there in the accepted canon of everything. But yeah, it takes a lot of creativity to think within the parameters, almost. You know, you're constrained by these characters or this universe, and you have to kind of find a way of making your own statement within it. And it's good that Lucas has been allowed that to happen. I think he, more than anyone, realizes he's built his empire, if you'll excuse the really terrible pun, off of, you know, the fact that the fans have supported, you know, I mean, Star Wars was completely audience driven. He realizes that the fans are completely behind his success.
Any advice for some young composers out there that are looking to maybe score a fan film?
First of all, don't feel like you have to clone everything Williams did. You have to find a way of making it feel like it's part of that without necessarily just aping, you know, cues that Williams wrote.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of people are too prone to, you know, it's kind of like they almost like rewrite the theme to, you know, whatever.
Right, right.
It's exactly the same except for like three notes. Or you just find, basically latch onto the drama. What's the scene about?
Mm-hmm.
You know, what underlying emotions are you going to play? They call it playing the action or playing kind of the underpinnings of what's going on.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it might seem like it's a happy scene, but maybe there's really something very melancholy and bittersweet about it that you play. Just find out, you know, really know what's going on, and in finding a point of view, you know, whose point of view are you telling, you know, is the score basically telling the story through?
Right. And one of the things I love about you, Steve, is that you enjoy talking about what you do. Well, you have a teaching background.
Right.
So you're a natural teacher in that way. You have an email address where listeners could email you if they're working on a fan film and they have some questions about maybe how to score this or that.
Yeah, actually, it's actually Rowlf26, R-O, I can't even spell today, R-O-W-L-F 26 at hotmail.com.
Rolf 26, and that is a Muppets reference.
It is a
right?
Muppets reference.
Well, Steve, I really, really appreciate you stopping by the cantina. Make sure you get another drink on your way out.
Be a little buzzed. Whatever this stuff is.
You're right. Thanks, Steve.
Thanks.
Hey, what are you trying to push on us?
A fine addition to my collection.
It's worth a lot to me.
And we're bounty hunting the latest Star Wars collectibles with the help of RebelScum.com. First up is the Hasbro 3¾ line. The Diamond exclusive Death Star Briefing Room 7-pack is now available for pre-order at Entertainment Earth. The multi-pack was unveiled at San Diego Comic-Con in July and features 7 figures, some of which never having ever been made in action figure format, including Grand Moff Tarkin, General Taggy, Admiral Mahdi, Chief Bast, Colonel Wolf Yularen, Officer Cass, and Darth Vader. I know I ordered mine.
This is a very cool set. This was, like you and I talked about, was the coolest set that came out of Comic-Con. This was the thing we were most excited about.
Yeah, absolutely. And it took me completely by surprise. I had no idea that this was in the works. So I was really happy about it. I kind of wish they would have put a briefing table with the set, but, you know, that's okay. I'll take the figures.
I'll make you a table. Just as long as we can get the figures, I'm cool with it.
And speaking of Entertainment Earth, they've revealed the package design for their Kier Kanos Karnor Jax comic 2-pack. The 2-pack is Hasbro's first significant entry in the Expanded Universe since 1998's Expanded Universe line of 9 figures. I think this looks awesome.
Yeah, it really, I thought it came out very nice. Everything looks just as I would envision when I was reading the Crimson Empire series.
Well, and this bodes well for the comic 2-pack line. It's kind of starting Hasbro's movement back into the Expanded Universe. I thought the packaging was reminiscent of the Shadows of the Empire 2-packs that they had out.
Yeah, the Boba Fett and IG-88, and then wasn't there a...
There was a Vader and Shizor.
Vader and Shizor, yeah.
Yeah, with the comic in the back.
And it's one of those things that it looks really great to display. If you open it, it'll be great. If you just want to display it, it'll look really cool as well.
Yeah, so check it out at entertainmentearth.com. And we've got the questions and answers for Hasbro's 9th Star Wars Q&A, posed by Rebel Scum readers.
Dear Hasbro, why do you keep retooling the TIE Fighter? First the engine detail, then the wings, and now you retooled the hatch. Why didn't you just retool the whole ship from scratch instead of doing Chinese torture on collectors, where you retool bits and pieces of the TIE Fighter on every random release? A new cockpit interior and proper gunwales would be next on the horizon for the next new release of the TIE Fighter of the future, methinks.
The TIE releases are not random, as you indicate. They are purposeful re-releases. It starts with our strategy of wanting to get an everyday price $20 TIE Fighter out there for kids and collectors in our Starfighter vehicle assortment. We could have taken the existing version, but we wanted to make it new rather than a straight repack. In addition to deco, we wanted to effect another aesthetic change to the hatch change. We didn't have a lot of tooling dollars to use. We were saving those for the new 2007 vehicles. But we could afford to update the hatch. This was a nice aesthetic change that we were able to execute.
Dear Hasbro, as 2007 is the 30th anniversary of Star Wars, will we see a larger percent of original trilogy characters who have never been made before compared to previous years? Characters like CZ3, Hermy Odal, Yarna Gargan, Tanaka Sisters, etc., would make great 30th anniversary presents.
Tough one to quantify, but I think collectors will be very happy with the selection of new original trilogy figures next year, including at least 2 that you mentioned. Ooh.
Dear Hasbro, are there any plans to release some of the upcoming tin set figures individually carded for a later release? Several of the new or retooled unique figures from these sets are considered army builders. I know that many fans and collectors would like to acquire multiples of these figures to add to their collections. Having them only available through the tin series is a bit prohibitive.
There are no plans now to release them down the road on individual cards. We do realize that there are some troop builders in there that in the future would be great to bring out on the 6x9 format, but we've planned so far down the road with the other figures. And if you have any burning Star Wars questions you need answered straight from the source, go ahead and post your questions in the thread on our forums at rebelscum.com, and with any luck, you might get your answers next week. And for a roundup of the whole community's questions and links to their answers, check it out at rebelscum.com.
In Sideshow news, the 12-inch figures continue to arrive in rapid fashion. Boba Fett, otherwise known as the UPS guy, delivered Bespin Han to my porch this week, and there are similar bounties out for Mace Windu and Obi-Wan Kenobi. Also revealed this week was the first glimpse of the highly anticipated Snow Buddy Padme. It was just the initial head sculpt, but it looks dead on, although the image of a head rotating on a post is a little bit creepy.
Yeah, even Natalie's head rotating is a little creepy.
Yeah, you know, she has that bald V for Vendetta look going on.
Yeah, totally. At least, whoever was sculpting that over at Sideshow, they had a perfect model for it. These Sideshows are killing me.
I love them to death. Absolutely love them. Have to have them.
Yeah, we had to have them about 6 months ago, and we ordered them.
Right.
And they promised us, quarter-long spread in between a lot of them. And now, all of a sudden, they're backlogged. We're going to get Obi-Wan, Mace Windu, Han, Bespin Han, and
Qui-Gon,
probably all going to ship within about 6 weeks of each other.
That's a little hefty dent in the old credit card there.
Yeah, it's like 300 bones we're talking about, but nothing compared to what's going to happen in January.
Yes.
Which, let's be honest, I would imagine that Jabba, Bib Fortuna, and Boosh will all be backlogged too, and we'll get them along with all the ones that we're probably going to be ordering this fall at once.
The only thing I can hope is that the stand for Jabba is big enough for me to lie on, because it may have to replace my bed. In Sideshow's team-up offers, there are two new items in their team-up with Acme that were revealed this past week. A Count Dooku character key, which at present is already sold out, but if you'd like to get on the waiting list, you can do that. And a new Star Wars Clone Wars Z-Clay print featuring the Jedi and Sith characters from the Clone Wars animated series, which are available for pre-order. Now, these Z-Clays, last week I was calling them Galicias. Because that's how it's spelled. But it's a French word, and it is actually pronounced Z-Clay.
Did you look it up?
I did have to look it up. And I had to look it up several times, in fact, in a couple different places, because a couple places it didn't show up, and other places it was in this strange foreign language that wasn't even French.
Do you remember what the definition was?
I believe it's a cool Star Wars print from Acme and Sideshow.
And on the heels of the life-size model, Master Replicas is now offering a scaled version of the Boba Fett blaster as seen in Return of the Jedi. The blaster went on sale this past week. $45 will get you the fearsome bounty hunter's weapon of choice, and it's still available at the Master Replicas site, and you can check out pictures at rebelscum.com. And pre-orders for 5 new General Giant items went up this week at StarWarsShop.com. You can check out Animated Luke and C-3PO maquettes, Han Solo on Tauntaun, the updated Jango Fett minibust, and the Luke as Jedi Knight minibust. I have to say, of all the merch that's out there right now, the minibusts are the things that I'm beating myself up over more than anything, of not getting on that bandwagon when it started.
Yeah, they've really caught on and become really cool representations of a lot of different characters. And
yeah, I refuse to start collecting them now, because you know how I am.
Yeah, it's just a little late. You're not going to get every one of every figure at this
point. No, I'll never get one of every bust, so that's it for me. But I'm going to oogle and admire other people's collections.
Yes, from a distance.
And you can check out a gallery of detailed photos of the Mara Jade minibust that was the Gen Con exclusive from earlier this summer at rebelscum.com.
From the Wizards of the Coast Star Wars miniatures game, 4 members of the Bounty Hunters expansion packs have been revealed this week. The Dark Hellion Swoop Gang member and Mustafarian Soldier will be common offerings in this set, and IG-88 and Tamteel Screege, a.k.a. Lando and Skiff Disguise, will be much harder to find. This set is set to debut in September.
And in LEGO news, the LEGO online store, Shop at Home, has added 2 new vehicles up for order. Currently available is the X-Wing Fighter set, which includes LEGO minifigures of Luke, Han, Leia, Chewie, R2, and the first LEGO incarnation of Wedge Antilles. Also up for pre-order is the Ultra Collector Series Darth Vader TIE Advanced Fighter, an exclusive set to the LEGO site, scheduled to ship in September.
That wraps up our bounty hunting segment for this week. For all the latest collector's news, head to rebelscum.com.
All the classic battles.
Delta Squad, execute door breach.
Any way you want.
We have all but destroyed the Jedi Knights.
Fight as a Jedi.
The Old Republic is crippled.
Fight in space.
Darth 3PO?
With just over a week until the September 12th release date, anticipation is running high for LEGO Star Wars 2, the original trilogy. Game trailers and a playable demo have been released to whet the appetites of eager fans, and the marketing team at LucasArts has teased the audience with screenshots and the just-released cover art for each of the platforms. This runs in stark contrast to the original LEGO Star Wars, which was released with very little fanfare and expectation, but became a huge hit because of its fun gameplay and some slapstick humor that made it fun for fans of all ages. This latest addition should not disappoint, as all the best elements of the original remain, with several great additions to keep the gameplay fun even after the game has been completed. One of the most intriguing new features is the ability to build and then pilot various vehicles, allowing this LEGO Star Wars to hit some previously out-of-reach places such as the Death Star Trench Run and a showdown with the Walkers on Hoth. Also new to this addition is a mix-and-match feature which allows you to interchange the parts of the characters, allowing you to explore the irony of Darth Vader's head on Ben Kenobi's body, or the hideousness of Greedo's head on Slave Leia's body. Finally, fans of the original can access bonus levels and characters based on how much of the original they were able to complete. So if you got hung up before beating it, you have a couple days to break it back out and finish it. All in all, the game looks great and should go a long way to please fans of the previous game and intrigue some new ones to pick it up. If you'd like to play the demo before you buy it, check out Rebelscum or TheForce.net for links to the download sites.
I'm excited about this game because these games are more my speed.
Absolutely.
As much as I love Battlefront, Battlefront 2, Knights of the Old Republic, I have to face facts. I'm not a good gamer.
Right. And this is definitely the one that everyone can jump on and sink their teeth to. And there's something for everybody. It's not a cakewalk. It's not a really horribly easy game, but it's very easy for those who want to make it easy.
And that's exactly what I need. It's kind of like Super Mario Bros. To my mind, it's like Super Mario Brothers meets Star Wars.
It has that very, very feel because there's just funny little things that are thrown in there. Check out the story from LucasArts on Rebelscum and TheForce.net that talks about all the things that are new to the game, where you can distract the members of Jabba's palace by making the Gamorrean guards rock out and things like that. I mean, they really took some liberties with finding a lot of funny little things to do, and comes down to simple things like when doing the Jedi mind trick on the stormtroopers, their helmets spin around, and just fun little things like that that just make you chuckle and make the game just a little bit more fun for everybody that's running through it.
I was once a Jedi Knight, the same as your father, before the dark times, before the Empire.
Always in motion is the future, beyond the outer rim.
Master Voss has moved his troops to Bos Pity.
In books this week, the second installment in the Legacy of the Force storyline was released with Bloodlines, a new paperback novel by Karen Travis. The plot finds tensions rising between the Skywalker and Solo families as a new galactic civil war seems inevitable. The situation gets even worse for our heroes when, from out of the ashes, Boba Fett returns. More on what Boba Fett has been up to can be found in Karen Travis's accompanying e-novel, A Practical Man. Both books now on sale wherever fine books are sold.
Each week in our Expanded Universe section, we will be featuring an EU character to bring people up to speed on the important characters that exist outside of the films. This week's character is Kier Kanos, whose action figure is due out this month. Kanos was an elite member of the Emperor's Royal Guard and fiercely loyal follower of Palpatine and the Empire.
Everything is proceeding as I have foreseen.
Kanos was identified early on as a skilled and fanatical warrior and was chosen to enter the hallowed ranks of the Royal Guard. Upon the completion of his training, Kanos was forced to slay a friend to prove his worth. When he showed remorse for the act, Darth Vader challenged him to a duel. Vader easily defeated him and left him with a lightsaber scar across his face to remind him that such things are unacceptable.
All too easy.
Kanos continued to serve the Emperor until the latter's death in the second Death Star. Having survived the Battle of Endor, Kanos continued to pursue the ideals of the fallen Empire and watch over the Emperor's most precious worlds. When the Emperor was reborn, Kanos and the remaining guard journeyed to join him, but retreated to their headquarters upon his death at the hands of Luke Skywalker.
It's the last mistake you'll ever make.
Upon their arrival, they were betrayed by rival guard Karnor Jax, who ordered all remaining guards slaughtered, and only Kanos managed to escape. After this, Kanos became relentless in pursuing Jax and all other traitors of the Empire. This became exceedingly difficult as he gained enemies at every turn and was often forced to ally himself with people who years prior he would have called foe. As the price on his head grew, he took on the bounty hunter persona of Kennex Kill, so that he could continue his pursuit of the traitors. Kanos remains at large in the post-Endor expanded universe.
Wow, what an appropriate EU character of the week there, with great timing with the action figure coming out.
Yes, absolutely. And I'm really excited about this figure because Kanos has always been a favorite of mine. I love the Crimson Empire stories when those first came out, and I've always been really fascinated with the Royal Guard and what goes on behind the scenes. And if you're looking for some really cool stories about the Royal Guard and what happens for them to actually become members of the Royal Guard, that's definitely the place to start is the Crimson Empire, and those are really great stories.
Well, EU is definitely where it's at, so we're going to be bringing you up to speed on everything that's going on in the Expanded Universe in the weeks to come. Pete is going to take on the mantle of our resident before the Battle of Yavin expert, and I'm going to try to bring you up to speed on things happening after the Battle of Yavin. Well, that's it for the Forcecast this week. Remember to keep your browser set to theforce.net and rebelscum.com.
And send us your feedback by emailing us at podcast@theforce.net. Every week, we'll be reading listener mail on the air, and we want your voice to be heard.
And please vote for us at Podcast Alley. And give us some love on iTunes by writing a review and telling us what you think.
And again, special thanks goes out to this week's sponsor, Official Picks. Check them out at officialpicks.com. Again, that's Picks with an X.
For the Forcecast, I'm Jason.
And I'm Pete.
And remember,
the Force will be with you, always.
This podcast is not endorsed by Lucasfilm Limited or 20th Century Fox and is intended for entertainment and information purposes only. The official Star Wars site can be found at www.starwars.com. Star Wars, all names and sounds of Star Wars characters, vehicles, and any other Star Wars related items are registered trademarks and or copyrights of Lucasfilm Limited or their respective trademark and copyright holders. All original content of this podcast is the intellectual property of the Force.net LLC unless otherwise indicated.